Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This week, all week, it's Answers in Genesis here at Bob Enyart Live. And this Sunday morning at Sunday School and Church at Denver Bible Church, we'll have a founding board member of AIG, Carl Kirby, speaking at Denver Bible Church. We're excited about that. You know, as Christians, we often talk about science and the Bible because if Christianity is true, then science, true science, should agree with the Bible. And if either the Bible or accepted science are wrong, then you would expect to find disagreement. Well, one of my favorite books we've mentioned over the years is Soul of Science by, I think, Thaxton and Kiersey. And the history of science. Well, if you look at the history of science, you could divide it into so many disciplines. Could you believe that you could get a PhD in the history of geology? Just that. And all the branches of the physical sciences, a PhD in the history of geology, and guess what? You know, an expert, what is an expert? Someone who knows more and more about less and less. A lot of experts in law and culture, they don't have truth behind them. But in science, it becomes fascinating the more you know about a specific subject. And at Answers in Genesis, they have a lecturer and a researcher on staff, Dr. Terry Mortensen, who has a PhD in the history of geology. Dr. Mortensen, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Thank you so much for joining us. The subject of your PhD thesis is one that we've actually talked about on this program occasionally over the years. And that's geology and what the early geologists believed. Can you set this up for us, help us begin a discussion of this topic?
Well, as you know, Bob, science, modern science, was born in the womb of Christianity. It was the Christian worldview, the assumptions about the nature of the world being an orderly creation of an intelligent God, that those assumptions paved the way for modern science and the study, orderly study of creation.
Now, Terry Mortensen, let me ask you right there about that. We have, because we're on a pretty powerful AM station in Colorado, a 50,000-watt 670 KLTT, we have people listening who are not all conservative Christians, and that might startle some of them hearing that that modern science was birthed in Christianized Europe. But how could we give a couple examples, like, let's say, Hinduism? Why doesn't modern science, why didn't it grow up in the Hindu worldview?
Well, the Hindu worldview really has a very low view of the physical creation. It emphasizes the spiritual realm, and that's why meditation and escape from reality.
And I guess they use the term Maya.
Yeah.
Maya for the universe, which means illusion.
Yeah. And the creation becomes even an object of worship. There are 300,000 gods in the Hindu religion, and so there's no interest in really studying the creation. The Hindu religion does not have a concept of an all-powerful creator, and
I guess when God created, God made the heavens and the earth and life, and he looked at it and he said it was very good.
That's right.
And that must contrast with the ancient Greeks. I think the pagan Greek philosophical creation myth was that God or gods were wrestling with pre-existing matter and tried to make something as best they could, but it didn't put a lot of faith in the physical world being worthy of study.
Right. In fact, many of the Greek philosophies viewed the physical world as evil and the spiritual world as good. So that led to either asceticism or, licentiousness, just gross immorality or, monkish type self-inflicted discipline. And so you you know, the philosophers thought a lot about ideas, but they didn't study the creation. So modern science, with its experimental method, was born in the assumptions of the Christian worldview, and all historians of science today would agree with that, whether they're Christians or not.
Right.
The Muslims had developed work in mathematics. The Chinese, of course, figured out gunpowder and rockets, but it didn't go any farther than that. It was the Christian worldview that gave birth to the modern science.
And when you say that the historians of science would agree with that, even the secular science historians, that actually they've, I guess, now recovered from a century or so of scientific revisionism, where Voltaire and others invented this hostility supposed between the church and science.
Yes.
And many in our public school system in America, they believe that the church and science have always been enemies, where in reality, science, modern science, was birthed within the church, within Christianized Europe.
Right, exactly. And one of the leading evolutionary historians of science was Andrew White at the end of the 19th century, and he wrote a book about the warfare between Christianity and science, and of course, in his view, science won every battle, but it was a very distorted historiography, and modern historians of science and philosophers of science over the last 20 or 30 years have totally repudiated his view of things.
For example,
not supported by the historical evidence at all.
And a lot of our listeners, if they're familiar with any area of this debate, it would probably be Galileo and the Pope. And
yeah.
Galileo is remembered in a revisionist historical way as being the man of science against Christianity and the Bible.
Right.
And therefore he was persecuted. But if I understand, you could check me on this. At the time of Galileo, in fact, for a couple thousand years, it was Aristotle and the pagan Greek philosophical view of the world that was the undisputed authority. And Galileo, he didn't like Aristotle. And he thought Aristotle's views about the world and the orbits of the planets and the sun revolving around the earth, he thought Aristotle was foolish, and many of those ideas, he ridiculed Aristotle, and he was challenged not because he was disagreeing with the Bible, but he was disagreeing with the pagan scientific view that had become entrenched.
It was not a battle between the Bible and science. It was a battle between different philosophical understandings.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's not often I get to speak to somebody who has a PhD in the history of science, but do you think that basic analysis I just described, is that reasonable?
Yeah, the Galileo affair is very complex, and there were lots of things going on there. Galileo was a fairly proud man, and he certainly aggravated his opponents in the way that he wrote about things. But,
oh, yeah.
That's good.
All right. Okay, so Terry, now let's, from that general foundation of Christianity not being hostile to the physical sciences, but contrary, being very supportive of them in the birthplace of modern science, how does the study of geology begin to form?
Well, geology did not become a professional science until the 19th century. Prior to that, there were, for a couple of centuries, men who were observing the rocks and the rock layers and the fossils to some extent. And up until about 1840, there were no professional geologists. Mm. You couldn't get a degree in geology. You weren't a paid geologist until about 1840. So before that, for about from the late 18th century into the early decades of the 19th century, the men who really developed geology into a separate field of science, as opposed to biology or astronomy, were geologists by avocation. They were wealthy men who had the financial means to wander about in the hillsides and study rocks and fossils, and it was their hobby. And then they wrote about what they studied. But they didn't become the leading geologists by the way that people do today, such as a PhD from a university. They were self-taught through field work and through reading.
All right. So the making of geology was sort of like the making of sausage or the news. It might not have been a pretty sight.
Right.
Okay.
And it was a long process, several decades before it really became the science that we think of today as the science of geology.
And so what were the dynamics? Was it simply a matter of men honestly looking at the world and trying to understand it? Did they bring their preconceptions with them? What happened early on?
Well, it was very much not just a purely objective science. In fact, philosophers of science and historians of science know and have been arguing for several decades that there's really no such thing as an unbiased, objective scientist. Nobody comes to any aspect of science with an empty brain. They all have assumptions about what they're looking for, what they will allow as an explanation, and certainly the men who were responsible in developing the idea of millions of years were every bit as biased as any Christian, any Bible-loving Christian. They were deist or atheist or some kind of vague theist in their orientation. They rejected the Bible, and some of the men actually wrote statements that clearly revealed their hostility towards the Scriptures.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask you a question about the subject you just brought up, our bias?
Mm-hmm.
I've had an interest in thinking through that for some time now. And let me ask you this question, because we Christians typically will admit if we're in the media or fighting creation evolution, we will go in admitting our bias and pointing out that the evolutionist and the mainstream news reporter, that they hide their bias. They pretend that they're objective when actually they twist every story or research report to their conclusion. But let me ask you this about bias. If God were to make a statement about the earth that he created, if he were to say, I created the earth and it revolves around the sun, would we say that that's a biased statement?
If God were to make that statement?
Right.
Well, no, because he is knows everything, and he always tells the truth. So,
right. So
he's just speaking reality.
So from his position of ultimate authority and truth, he makes statements that are not biased, even though they happen to all side with him.
Right.
They're not biased because they're true.
Right.
So if we make a statement that the earth orbits the sun— that's not necessarily a biased statement. If it's, would you agree that if our statements are true, they're not biased?
Yes, if they're true to reality, they're not necessarily biased. Our bias may affect our interpretation of what we see, but it may not.
So
that's why, you know,
right.
An atheist and a Christian can look at the same thing. Say they can look at two molecules of hydrogen and one molecule of water and say, yeah, or one
oxygen, yeah.
Oxygen and say, yeah, that's a molecule of water. It's not carbon dioxide and it's not lead and it's not
right.
Anything else. So
when we're admitting our bias, what we mean is if we are wrong in interpreting some data, we're likely to err on the side of creation. But that doesn't mean that we're saying our entire worldview is biased, right? I'm just trying to clarify that. I'm curious about that topic.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Rephrase it.
All right. When we openly say that we admit our bias, and our bias is toward a creator God who made the earth, it seems that that's only our bias if it's not true. If it's false, if God did not make the earth, then we're biased. But
yeah.
If it's true, objectively, God made the earth. And so when we interpret some specific, say, scientific experiment, our bias then, we might be biased how we interpret the results of that detail.
Sure.
And we, since we're not infallible, we may get that wrong, and we make sure our error goes in the direction of young earth creationism.
Well, I would hope that we don't twist the evidence, and certainly that has happened even with Christians. As
mm-hmm.
you said, we're not infallible. But maybe the word bias is a little bit confusing and slippery. it might be better to use the word assumptions and presuppositions.
All right.
In other words, we all, creationists or evolutionists, all make an assumption that, for example, that our 5-sense perception of you know, hearing and seeing and touching, etc., is basically reliable. We know that we can be deceived because people see oases in the middle of the desert when there really isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, all of science, all of life is based on the assumption that our 5 senses are basically reliable. And so when we go into the laboratory and we see two chemicals form together, we are assuming, we're all assuming, regardless of our religious orientation, that we're seeing things basically accurately.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then there are other assumptions, such as the evolutionist will assume that there is no God, and then he assumes that everything that we see in the world must be explained by three agents: time, chance, and the laws of nature.
All right.
Working on matter. Whereas the Christian says, no, there is a God. I have good reasons to believe there is a God. And therefore, when I look at the world, I'm not going to assume that it can only be explained by time and chance and the laws of nature.
Mm. So our presupposition is that because there is an intelligent God, we expect to see order and reason in our existence.
Yes, and we may actually see evidence of supernatural activity.
Right.
Because the laws of nature and time and chance cannot explain what we observe, and so we are not, as Christians, we're not averse to saying, okay, that may be evidence of something that God actually made, or that may be evidence of God working in time-space history, such as in Noah's flood. Noah's flood was, in the Bible, was not just a natural accident that it just happened in 1600 years after the creation that everything went chaos and the whole earth was flooded. That event was triggered by a supernatural act of God in judgment.
It was somehow orchestrated by God because of sin in the world.
That's right. It didn't just happen by accident. And
all right. Okay, so now and I apologize if I need to, Dr. Terry Mortensen, for taking us on these tangents, but these are issues that have fascinated me for many years, even these basic ideas.
Well, I think they're important questions because a lot of Christians are under the illusion, and a lot of non-Christians, in fact, most evolutionists are actually operating on the illusion that they are simply observing the facts and the facts speak for themselves. And most scientists who go even through a PhD program, they are not very well trained, if at all, on philosophy and the philosophical assumptions involved in the scientific enterprise. So they don't even realize that they're using philosophical assumptions in their work. They think they're just letting the facts speak for themselves.
Right. And that is fascinating. Okay, so now I'll try not to distract us again as we're getting to geology, to the formation of geology now.
Okay, so prior to the 19th century, the dominant view in the Western world where science was born was that the Bible gave us a true history of the world and that the world was about 6,000 years old, that there had been a global flood, and the few people prior to the 19th century who thought about that much in relationship to the rocks believed that the rocks and the fossils were a testimony to Noah's flood.
All right.
But in the late 18th century, that view began to be challenged by men who did not embrace the Christian worldview. They were deists or atheists, and so they began to try to explain the rock record by time and chance and the laws of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up first with a view known as catastrophism, which said that the layers of rock had been formed by multiple catastrophes over long ages. There were regional or global catastrophes, floods, that wiped out most of the creatures or maybe even all of the creatures. And these occurred every so often over long ages, long before man appeared. And after each of these catastrophic floods, God created new forms of life to replace what had been destroyed. And that view of catastrophism ruled for about 30 years in geology.
All right.
And then it was replaced by a view that became known as uniformitarianism, based on the word uniform, because this view said that all of the processes we observe today in terms of erosion, sedimentation, volcanic activity, earthquake activity, it's all been happening at a uniform rate, the same rate and intensity that we see happening today on average per year, all the way back through time. So the uniformitarians, they just made a philosophical assumption. Obviously, this was not an observation. They didn't live through all those long ages to observe that there had never been any regional or global catastrophic floods. They just assumed that there never had.
Right.
And insisted that assumption should govern the interpretation of the rock record.
And if we look at the Earth, I like how Ken Ham, the founder of Answers in Genesis, says what we see is we see billions of dead things laid down by water, buried in rock strata all over the Earth. And that's not happening today. We don't have thousands or millions of animals every year buried and fossilized. So something happened in the past that was had a worldwide effect of creating billions of fossils that's not happening during the period of the study of modern science.
That's right. And
right there, it should have showed them there's a slight fallacy in their view.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at a place like the Grand Canyon where we can see these layers a mile deep stacked on top of each other like pancakes, and the geologists can trace those layers. They just go laterally for hundreds of miles in all directions, and there's no place on Earth where sediments are being laid down in that form.
Mm-hmm.
It's a unique testimony to a unique event in the past.
What?
But that uniformitarian view took hold of geology by about 1840, and it became the ruling dogma of geology, so that every student who was trained in geology was trained to think in this uniformitarian way of slow, gradual processes of erosion and sedimentation over millions of years produced the features that we see.
Hmm.
And so the evolutionists say that the Grand Canyon layers took 300 million years to lay down, and the canyon itself took millions of years to erode. And that view of uniformitarianism controlled geology for over 150 years until a very surprising thing happened in about the 1970s.
All right.
And that was that evolutionary geologists themselves began to argue that the rocks were screaming catastrophe, and that this uniformitarian assumption that had been a dogma of geology for so long was actually false.
So that today we have detractors among the evolutionists.
Right, and in fact, there are probably no pure uniformitarians left on the planet.
On the planet, they're modified uniformitarianists?
Yes, and they are embracing more and more catastrophic ideas. In fact, the dominant view for the disappearance of the dinosaurs, the extinction of the dinosaurs, is
a catastrophic
event, an asteroid impact that they think has left evidence in the Yucatan Peninsula and the Gulf of Mexico,
mm-hmm.
although that's disputed.
Right.
They're entertaining, for many rock formations now, they are entertaining catastrophic explanations. And in some cases, they're saying, we're not only entertaining the possibility, the rocks are telling us loud and clear.
It has to be.
That without the stranglehold, the brainwashing of uniformitarian assumptions, the rocks are clearly telling us that these particular formations were formed rapidly, catastrophically.
You know what I would love to see, as I've read through some of your writings, which are, by the way, fascinating, and they're available at answersingenesis.org. You write about an early scriptural geologist who gave us the first maps of England and Wales, geological maps of the strata. I think it'd be so neat if creationists took that and marked these places where we know the strata formed rapidly, and on a globe, a digital globe, begin to put around the Earth where we have evidence like polystrate fossils, where a tree is standing vertically through through seven layer of strata that supposedly were laid down over millions of years. And here's this tree in solid rock. And so we know that there at that point, those layers were laid down rapidly. But if we take that evidence and extrapolate it, follow those strata layers for as far as they go, we might be able to show hard evidence that all the major strata of the world was laid down rapidly by virtually incontrovertible evidence.
Well, there's already a mounting effort in that regard, and there's been a lot of, in the technical creationist literature, reinterpretations of actual formations published in the TJ, the Technical Journal of AIG.
That's a fabulous.
And the Creation Research Society Quarterly, which publishes, has been publishing for 30 years.
Both of those are tremendous. And let's just let our audience know, maybe for now we'll stick with TJ, Answers in Genesis. They've got Creation Magazine, which is perhaps for a more popular audience.
Yes, it's a family magazine, but every article is fully documented for the serious reader.
It's just great. Creation Magazine, full color. And then there's TJ, Technical Journal, which if you're scientifically inclined, technically inclined, you will love reading TJ, Technical Journal.
Yeah, well, it keeps you up to date on the cutting edge of creationist research. And although it's technical, lots of the articles would be understandable to many laymen.
Yeah, that's
as well.
Right. That's right.
And you can at least understand the abstract, the introduction and conclusion to at least stay abreast of what's going on in science.
Dr. Terry Mortensen, you are a researcher with Answers in Genesis. I'd like to know if we can continue this tomorrow, Friday. This whole week is Answers in Genesis week here at Bob and Yurt Live, and we're just out of time right now. Would you be able to do that with us?
I'd be glad to, Bob.
Well, that sounds great. I want to thank you so much. I'll put you on hold right now. Love to talk to you for just a moment once we get off the air, if you can hang on. We have the website, answersingenesis.org. Fascinating. You've got a question about science, the Bible. That's a good place to begin looking for answers. And one of their founding board members, Carl Kirby, will be in Denver, in fact, tomorrow night. Tomorrow at Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada, Carl Kirby is giving the commencement address for the graduating class. And by the way, that Christian school in Arvada, typically a quarter of their students go on to study engineering at School of Mines in Golden, which is just a tremendous college. So if you'd like to hear Carl Kirby from AIG, come to Denver Bible Church Sunday morning, because since he's here this weekend, we've got him coming out to do Sunday school at 9:30 for an hour. And then the church service starts at 11, and Carl will have the sermon time. So I think we'd like to give Answers in Genesis a warm welcome at Denver Bible Church, and we invite you to come on out. It's near Hampton and Wadsworth. You can find us on the web. That's the best way to get directions, a map. Just go to denverbiblechurch.org, denverbiblechurch.org. So thank you for tuning in. Looking forward to tomorrow's show. Oh, and by the way, if you go to our website, kgov.com, top right-hand corner, you could shop online and get our Bob and Yurt Live teaching materials on the Bible, Genesis, creation, debates with evolutionists. You'll love to explore there, so check it out. And now this is Bob and Yurt reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.